Before we begin, I would like to emphasize that this podcast is separate from my teachings and work at Del Seton Medical Center. Any discussions we have on this podcast is for entertainment purposes only and in no way connected to Del Seton Medical Center.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Life of Flow. Today we had a great discussion with Scott Nelson. He's the CEO of the company Fastwave, and he'll give us a little bit of a, I would say, tour de life here about where he started, how he got to where he is, and some of the future projects. I thought it was very entertaining and lots of tips and tricks for you entrepreneurs out there. So tune in.
Vamos.
Let's do it.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
We launched the site on a whim in early 16. Did a little bit of revenue that year and kind of learned a lot basically over the course of that first year. And then, circling around to like early 17, the business just started blowing up, just started taking off like a rocket ship.
Where did you find the devices that you decided to start selling online?
Initially, we tried to identify something that we could use off the shelf, right? That didn't require a ton of customization, but that met certain quality standards. And so, initially went to Alibaba, actually. This was back in the back half of 2015 to figure out what manufacturers, if any, we could potentially work with and leverage off the shelf devices and with some minor modifications versus wholesaling, building a custom product. Because as you guys probably know, that process is pretty intense from a capital perspective as well as a timeline. And we just wanted to see, is this thing going to work, right? Before pouring, hundreds of thousands of dollars into it. And I think that's one of the key lessons for anyone that's listening, that's sort of bent towards, the world of startups, is try to first determine if you're going to have product market fit, right? Before you throw too much at any certain project. That's the key. And if you can do that in a really lean and efficient way, that's phenomenal, right? Because you can just try a lot of things without wasting too much time or capital on any one thing before there's traction. And so, just identified, circling back around to your question, Miguel, identified a manufacturer, and that's what allowed, and we tweaked and modified an off-the-shelf device. And that was our first version, right, that we commercialized online. And the company, I mean, just to kind of put in perspective, the company took off like a rocket ship. So we went from, $0 in revenue to, mid $20 million in revenue within a few years, entirely online, direct to consumer. And so no other channels, no retail, no wholesale. That was it. But that's just a testament to trying a lot of things, right? Being curious and trying a lot of things and just getting a number of reps in.
Did you have any experience managing, companies, working the logistics, supply chains, anything like that? Or did you just win?
Yeah, I think my experience in large strategics certainly helped to a certain extent, right? In a number of ways. One is I grew up kind of in the commercial world in sales and marketing positions, so I think naturally I'm decent at that. But then inside a large strategic, if you're in a kind of a marketing capacity, a lot of times you're interacting with R&D, supply chain, quality, reg, so you get to touch a lot of different functions, and so. So I think certainly that helped, but that experience with Juve was really the first hit, right, that I really had on my own. And I think for anyone listening that's interested in this sort of world, right, of entrepreneurialism, whether you've got an idea for a device or something else, like it's about taking swings at the plate, right? Getting reps in and taking swings at the plate. I always like to use an analogy. When you look at a stat sheet from LeBron James game or something like that, or Steph Curry, you never see them going like 6 for 9, from the floor. It's always like 15 of 30 or something like that, right? They take a lot of shots. And so that's another important kind of lesson learned for me over the years in the world of startups, is you gotta take a lot of shots, take a lot of swings.
So as you look back at Juve, what would you say were the key components that acted as catalyst to you converting a $0 to $20 million project?
Right. Well, I think when most people think of direct-to-consumer businesses, they think of, like, you know, paid ads on Facebook and Instagram and search on Google. But that's not actually how we grew the business. In fact, we grew the business almost entirely on the backs of influencers, health and wellness influencers, people in the longevity space. And so some of these folks are like Ben Greenfield, Dave Asprey, who's the founder of Bulletproof Coffee. He was really popular back in the day. Ben was sort of, I like to call him kind of, he took the baton from Tim Ferriss, right, early on when Tim was really more into biohacking. You know, and that led to, you know, interacting with people like Rick Rubin and getting devices into the kind of the professional sports arena. And, you know, one thing kind of, you know, working slowly up the chain, one thing led to another. And I've got some pretty fun stories around that. But this concept of influencer marketing, if you will, was really kind of a big aha for me coming out of that experience. And that was a big learning too, is it was always amazing looking back how much influence some of these people have, right? There's a reason, you know, we joked around about Joe Rogan earlier before we hit the record button, but he's got a tremendous amount of influence, right? That drives a tremendous amount of behavior. And so that was a big lesson learned for me kind of coming out of the Juve experience.
Do you think there's a role in this, in a way is useful for me, because I am building Hope Vascular and Podiatry, right? I left corporate America or the hospital corporations, and I'm starting my own thing. And then also through the Life of Flow podcast, when we think about, and when we've had these discussions behind the scenes, we talk about the power of influencers. But right when you now, of course, back in the days, you probably had a very minute group of people that you could possibly reach. And now it's almost like a derogatory thing, right? It's like, oh my God, influencers in the wild, right? And so you have this gamut of people. So do you think, A, within influencers, there's subclasses of influencers for different types? And more specifically, what sort of influencer in healthcare do you believe is the prime influencer entity that one should, A, find, B, support, C, polish, and somehow feed these opportunities to?
Yeah, and there's certainly, to answer your first question, there's certainly sort of levels or degrees of influencers, right? Because for anyone listening to this, you're probably thinking, wait a second, this guy's talking about like influencers on Instagram that are like doing selfies at the Whole Foods, you know what I mean? I'm not talking about that world. I mean, I am to a certain extent, but I love this concept of influencing for good. Right. And so I think there's a lot of, you know, physicians and clinicians that listen to the Life of Flow podcast. And the argument I would make to you listening is that don't view that word as derogatory, because you have a lot of influence and you can use that influence for good in a very, very, very positive way. And so when I talk about influencers, I think it's best to kind of frame it up around that, but also don't be afraid of that as well. Kind of lean into that, because you do have a remarkable amount of influence. And that was one of the key things that I realized coming out of that Juve experience, is that, you know, the best influencers, quote unquote influencers, that we worked with were very, very thoughtful. They were very well read. They understood exactly, you know, they understood the domain really, really well. And because of that, they had an audience that really, really listened to them.
Were they physicians?
What they had to say.
Were they specifically physicians or no?
Somewhere, you know, you have physicians like Dr. Peter Attia, who's pretty well known. Mm-hmm. Andrew Huberman, although he wasn't as popular, you know, back in the day. He's not a physician; he's, I guess, a PhD. But somewhere. But others were just very, very into the longevity space. Ben Greenfield is another one. He's not a physician; I think he maybe has a master's in science, but he's extremely well read. Right. And so he has a very loyal audience that listens to almost every word he says, because he goes deep right on a subject and brings them very, you know, very good, intelligent information that they can use and adapt and apply to their own lives. And so, working with the right influencers was extremely helpful from a business perspective. And I think there's a lot of ways that applies, right, to the world that that I'm in now, right, which is kind of more traditional med tech. But I think in addition to that, there's a lot of physicians that I run into that could probably use their influence in a lot of different ways, right? And you guys are a perfect example with this podcast, right? I mean, I don't know of any other vascular surgeons maybe that have a podcast and are committed to like producing content like this, but there's a ton of value that you're delivering, right, to an audience that it, you know, will trust and begin to kind of intimately know you guys, you know, personally, you know, through the audible word. And so I think that's a really, really good thing. And I think that's a kind of an untapped concept, right, in the world of in this kind of world that we operate in.
Yeah, and going back to the influencers, isn't like keynote speakers that isn't, you know, big medical device, BD, Medtronic, Boston has been doing that forever. It's just in a stage, in a conference, they paid for some lunch and they put somebody in there to talk about their data. Same exact thing.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, they're often referred to as KOLs, right? Key opinion leaders.
Yeah. This has way more leverage because that, you know, requires physical time, physical space. This doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. And I would say that this concept has been around for quite some time, right? You know, when I say influencers, someone that's spent their career in med tech would say, well, you're talking about KOLs, right? Yes, to a certain extent, but the big missing component is a lot of people think of influence as being on podium, right? And I'm not dismissing that. There's obviously a lot of great information that you can disseminate. But that's a one-time thing, right? Once a year at this conference, you're going to speak on podium maybe a couple times. There's so much more domain expertise that you have with everything that you're seeing and the patient interaction on a weekly basis that I'm sure a lot of other physicians would be like, well, what do you do when this happens, or what do you do when that happens, or there's a lot more experiences, right, that you can disseminate versus just a one-time kind of podium talk, if you will.
Plus, it also appeases to the fact that the next generations are all taking their information in a very different way.
Yeah.
You know, before you would have these meetings with thousands of people in auditoriums. I remember being in auditoriums where you couldn't even sit. And now it's actually rare to go to a meeting and find an auditorium that's full.
Yeah,
because there's so much access to information that comes in different ways. And so I would agree that I think us three, you started this way, way earlier. How long have you been? And it could be a great pivot to the other thing that Scott does, because I want to understand through your podcasting career, you are the founder and the host alone of the MedSider podcast. And I was surprised. I'm sorry. I don't want to be insulting. I was surprised it's been around for a long time. And I can't tell you in the last year how many times I have Googled or seeked information about specifically what you talk. And somehow I just never came across this one unique, excellent place where what you do is on a regular basis bring medtech leaders to talk about their journeys and what's worked with them and what hasn't worked with you, which in a way I think has been an absolute encyclopedia for you throughout the years leading up to this current role as a CEO for a medtech company, which we'll get to. But tell me about why you start the podcast. And tell me even more, how bad was it at the beginning? Because I was just telling Lucas on the way here, I was like, man, I hate listening to me myself, right? Like the first few times I either ramble. My wife says, you're such a mansplainer.
You've always done that, dude.
But I need to stop. Have you realized that today I've been like pulling back myself a little bit more? And then also, you know, I said I was going to sober up for this one because you shouldn't be drinking when you do these. You lose a little bit of your control.
Speak for yourself.
That's fine. The king of preparedness over here. He's going to prepare a ton of drinks. But anyway, back to the question. So when did you start? How did it start? And how bad did you suck at it at the beginning?
Let me get to MedSider one quick second, but I mentioned that kind of back to this idea of physician influence. I mentioned Andrew Huberman, right? Just a few minutes ago. But he's this guy that's like taken off. I mean, he's so, so popular now in kind of this biohacking longevity space. And, you know, he started off in podcasts, right? And then that led to like him really, you know, taking clips of that podcast and posting on Instagram. And now he has massive, massive Instagram following, et cetera. But he's influencing for good in a reasonably unique way, right? At least unique to probably the academics that he's around at Stanford, as an example, right? So there's a lot of different ways that you can disseminate information and have influence. You know, but like that's why, you know, I'm a big fan of what you guys are doing, is like, you know, start with a podcast and kind of see where it goes, you know. And that's sort of what I did with MedSider, just to kind of circle back around to your question, Miguel. I started the show, gosh, back in 2009. Because I was a big podcast listener back then. This was when, you know, the only app the only podcast app on your phone was the Apple podcast app, right? Spotify wasn't around then. And, you know, it was kind of a new format. I was super into it though. There was a bunch of startup podcasts that I listened to back in the day, but there was nothing on MedTech. And I was around all of these devices, these cool new devices that were being used. I saw them and I was like, where do these things come from? You know, like how did this vascular surgeon and this interventional cardiologist is using this new tool. Like, where did it come from? What's the story behind it? And there's nothing available. So I was like, well, I want to scratch my own itch here, and I'll just do it then. Right. So I started recording podcasts, the content was like super, like it ebbed and flowed. Right. Based on kind of what I had on my plate. So there'd be 6 months where I'd be really consistent with the content. And then, you know, 6 months would go by and it was like, I'd record just a couple podcasts. But at the end of the day, I kept doing it because I was just naturally curious. I was awful at first, for sure. No doubt. I still don't listen to a lot of my own shows. Every now and then I do, if it was like a particular interesting conversation, but a lot of times I don't re-listen because I don't necessarily like to hear my own voice. But yeah, it's definitely a craft that you kind of hone by just doing it, you know, doing it a lot. You just get better. It's just like any other skill set. But one of the reasons that I kept doing it is one, I was just, again, curious, you know, naturally curious about the content. So that was one thing that kind of continued to fuel the fire. And then secondarily, podcasts, as you guys know, has really blown up, right, over the past, you know, five years or so. And I saw it as a medium that could ultimately potentially become valuable, you know, for me personally. I didn't know exactly what that looked like. Still don't know entirely. I mean, it's certainly synergistic to what I'm doing now. But I don't, it's not something I've had like a business model around from the get-go, right? So it was a combination of, you know, being naturally curious about this subject matter, but also seeing the value that a lot of other podcasts have, and thinking that, you know, there probably would be some value ultimately, you know, and continuing to kind of build this thing up.
You know, one of the things that I like the most about your pod is the detail information on the pod. I don't know how, which platform do you upload to? Do you use Spotify as your main?
No, I host on Transistor, and then it automatically syndicates to, you know, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, et cetera. But I mean, 98% of my listens come from Apple Podcasts. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Well, we're hosting on Spotify, right? Because we wanted the video. It was called Anchor, and now it's Spotify for Podcasters, because we wanted video. All right. Yeah. Ali, our producer, saying you guys were insistent on video and that was probably the better one. And so, but you know what I do is I'm curious, of course, now more than ever, and obviously hypercritical. So I'll go in and I'll read and I'll like find either typos or things that I didn't like. And I'm like, you know, being mean and aggressive and passive aggressive towards Ali in the middle of the night when doctors get home and do all these things. It's so funny because, you know, they live a completely different life from us. And I'm like, hey, 7 a.m. meeting works for everybody. And I've got all these millennials like, what the fuck?
Yeah, man? I know.
Like, what are you
outside,
doing?
Trying to
what
not wake everyone to us, up.
Right. But I mean, it's working. They've been great. Ali, we love you. But to say the descriptors of your podcast are second and like I have not seen one that good. Who puts that effort into that? Because it's a ton of information. It's links. It's hyperlinks. It's followers. Like, it's very well and thought out.
Well, thank you for that. That's definitely been an ever evolving process, right? But I've got a team of writers that I pay for. I mean, this is an endeavor that I fund myself. But I've got a team of writers that will listen to the show. And then come up with about a 3,000 word write-up that kind of summarizes the learnings. And that was one thing, again, kind of under the disguise of kind of scratching my own itch. A lot of times I would listen to a podcast and be like, I don't want to re-listen to it, but can I go back and look at the show notes? But a lot of times the show notes are just bullet points. And you know, there's not much substance there. It's like, can I get a little bit more than that? And so that was one of the ideas that I had that I kind of wanted to see. And so I just started doing it. And I think it's really been popular. But it also, I think, helps, you know, further grow the show too, because it's unique. And a lot of podcasters don't I guess commit to that type of effort, because it is work, right? But I think it's also, you know, it delivers a lot of value too, as well at the same time. But I think there's a number of different ways that I could repurpose the content as well. It's just kind of a function of time and resources. maybe offline we'll talk about some other ideas how you guys could repurpose some of this too. If not Ali's probably already brought some of these ideas to the table.
How do you leverage your podcast for your other ventures? So you know, how is it helpful for your other kind of probably more bigger projects or primary projects?
Yeah. So I mean, 95% of my time, if not more, you know, I mean, I certainly spend more than 40 hours a week on Fastwave, right? But if you look at kind of the pie of where I spend my time, is on Fastwave, right? That's a significant commitment. It's a really fun company, and where I think we're well positioned, and making a lot of really good progress. But it's helpful. For Fastwave, really because of two things, right? I mean, the main job I think of any startup CEO is keeping money in the bank, number one, and then two, building out a team, right? It doesn't necessarily have to be a team of full time employees, but it could be a team of consultants, etc. And interviewing hundreds of other startup founders and CEOs now, I have a pretty significant network of people that I can just, if I've got a question, I can ping them right away, and I'll get a response back immediately. That's also helped me to build out like a network of regulatory folks, clinical folks, et cetera, that have a bias towards startups. So I can tap into kind of a unique community of people that like want that know how startups work, right? In med tech, and then from a capital perspective, you know, raising capital is probably the one of the most significant challenges I think for any startup CEO, especially in med tech. It's kind of like playing the game on hard mode. And then you layer that up against the current backdrop of the fundraising environment. It's extremely challenging. So one of the big things is just raising awareness for the project that I'm working on, right? And by recording podcasts, producing content, writing op-eds for Forbes, for MD&DI, various outlets, like that helps raise the level of awareness kind of within the broader community for what we're trying to build at Fastwave.
And can we transition into Fastwave? Can you give us a little bit of the backdrop? How did you come into the project? Is this something that you kind of started from the beginning? Did somebody bring you in? How did that start?
Yeah, it was spun out of a kind of a venture studio. I like to call it that because it probably resembles more of a venture studio that I'm involved with called Big Sky Biomedical. And a lot of the projects that we work on come from physicians, right? So we have kind of a unique model around, hey, Dr. Smith has this great idea. How do we actually bring this to life? And so it was kind of a project that spun out of that. Fastwave didn't necessarily come from a physician per se, but we spun it out of that venture studio. Actually started working on it as a quote unquote project back in mid 2020. And decided to pursue it with more rigor because of a couple things. One is that we expected intravascular lithotripsy or IVL to continue to be utilized on a greater basis, I think, which is come to fruition for sure, in large part because of Shockwave Medical's great execution. But in addition, when the USPTO ruled almost overwhelmingly in favor of a company called CSI, their IPR efforts to invalidate a lot of key patents that Shockwave had, we thought that was a classic why now moment for us to get to pursue the project with more rigor. And so we started working on it as a team in the back half of 2020, spun the company out as a Delaware C Corp, a standalone Delaware C Corp in early 21. And then pursued a Series A round of capital and closed on that about 6 months later. Because up until that point, we didn't raise any seed money. We'd funded it entirely by ourselves. And so went straight to a Series A, closed that in August of 21, And that was the first major infusion of capital into the company, which allowed us to kind of begin to build out the broader team and really kind of hit the gas pedal on our development efforts. And so, now we're, recording this in Q4 of 23 and, have been able to come up, build a couple different IVL systems that we feel really good about, moving forward. And I think the company's pretty well positioned for our clinical efforts on the near horizon.
You flew by the court decision about CSI. Can you dive into that a little bit more? And how did that legal background say, okay, this is the moment?
Yeah, I think so that's a great question. So I think any startup, I think when you look back at kind of why it took off or why it actually became a thing, there's usually a why now moment. Like why now? Why should investors deploy capital into this thing? Why should a group of people come together to work on it, et cetera? There's always sort of a why now moment. And if the USPTO hadn't ruled almost overwhelmingly in CSI's favor, we probably wouldn't have ever worked on the project. And what I mean by that, just to be a little bit more pragmatic, is CSI, Cardiovascular Systems, they were recently acquired by Abbott. They initiated what's called an IPR effort to invalidate Shockwave's three key patents, and this is all in the public domain. So I'm not sharing anything that's not public. But they were extremely successful. I think when that team at CSI led that or started that initiative, I think a lot of people thought they were crazy, and probably myself included. But they ended up winning pretty big, and so we were following that and thought, well, that this is interesting, and it's even more interesting when the USPTO ruled the way they did in such quick fashion. And so we thought there's probably a little bit more room to operate than I think most people realize with respect to IP. And so that's one of the reasons we decided to kind of go a lot deeper and choose this project versus others.
Was this not to dive too deep into this, but was this because CSI had previously put in some IP regarding lithotripsy?
No. So I didn't even know what the term IPR was right before this. Just to kind of level set on that. But it's a process to basically invalidate a company's patents. In essence, if I had to kind of try to attempt to dumb it down, I'm certainly not an IP attorney by any stretch of the imagination. But you're basically appealing to the USPTO to say these patents that have been granted, they're not valid because there's all of this existing art in the public domain that predates all of the IP. And so that's kind of the argument that you're making to the USPTO. And surprisingly, the USPTO agreed almost overwhelmingly and said, yeah, we agree. There's a lot of art in the public domain that predates all of Shockwave's patents. So like these three key patents that were invalidated, yep, we believe and accept your argument, and they were invalidated.
You would think CSI was planning on coming up with an IVL product, because why would you go through the expenditure of doing that if you didn't execute on it?
Yeah, and I think they wanted to, right?
That was kind of their plan
about their efforts. I don't know how far along they are now that they're kind of under the Abbott umbrella, but I think that was sort of one of the underlying intentions of them doing this, is they wanted to get into the space and probably sort of, for lack of a better description, kind of clear the pathway a little bit, right, to enter.
So we shouldn't be surprised if you sell to Abbott at some point in the next 24 months.
Fingers crossed.
This topic is quite interesting, though, because I know you had Dr. Peter Schneider on the show, which was a really, really great interview, I think, I don't know, a month ago-ish or something like that. And obviously very, very successful entrepreneur, successful physician in his own right, of course. But you touched on IP previously, and that's just something to keep in mind. For anyone else that's working on projects, is that just because you have a patent doesn't necessarily mean it's an easy road or all the dominoes are going to fall after that. That's certainly not the case.
It just adds to the feeling of being overwhelmed by the amount of things you need to learn. Because how much effort you have to put in to bring a project, and then you're like, okay, I have this IP, but now you have the uncertainty of like, oh, someone might come like for some reason, I have no idea, out of left field, and invalidate my patent, and then goes away. It's crazy.
One of the things I like your opinion on this, you're mentioning Peter, and I think Peter is a great guy, but he's also very smart politically and very politically correct. So I try to tease, you know, kind yeah. of to throw some treats in and see how much I would get out of him. But he was very shifty and very smart and not addressing it. But I wanted him and now you to give me a comment on the complicated position that we as physicians get ourselves in when we are working with companies at a startup level, being that, to your point previously, we have this trust in the community and we can exert our influence mm-hmm. in a way, right? And so how do you maneuver conflict of interest in the setting of entrepreneurship when there are certainly more physicians nowadays than before interested in coming up with technology and ideas? And we have a lot of young physicians that come from engineering backgrounds. And so I see this more and more, but it seems like regulatory pathways change a lot, are very shifty. And right now we're under a pretty draconian, I think, phase where I know phenomenal speakers that have been asked to not speak because of some relationship. So, you know, people that have the most experience on a particular device cannot even have a comment. So in this you know, short career with your company, have you noted that? Because I know how intimately related FastWave is with physicians, both as investors and as strategics. What's your take on this, and how should we maneuver this regulatory hassle?
Yeah, no, it's a great topic, and I'll maybe try to offer some things from my perspective on how to navigate this, because it's very relevant to what we're doing at FastWave. We just closed on a round of financing fairly recently, and it was a significant amount of capital, and the overwhelming majority of it came from physicians, which is we feel incredibly grateful for that, right? Because it's, you know, to have the support of domain experts that are saying, I like that technology, there needs to be another player. You know, I'm investing my own capital, my own money into that project. I mean, that's a amazing testament, and feel incredibly grateful for that. But I think, kind of to circle back around to your question, Miguel, and maybe get to the heart of it, is I actually think it's a good thing. I fundamentally think it's a good thing for physicians to collaborate with industry in this type of capacity. But it could go one of two ways, right? If you have sort of the wrong players, right? Then I think it leads to people, you know, a lot of skepticism. But if you're working with the right people, right? Peter Schneider, since we brought him up, is a great example. He knows how to sort of divide the worlds, right? And he's not going to, when someone, whether it's a venture capitalist or a strategic company that's interested in the company, is going to ask him about a particular product or system or whatever device, he's not afraid to disclose that and be transparent. And I think that's the key, because I think we've all been to conferences where a physician will get on podium and start their talk, and they rattle off a bunch of disclosures as it happens so fast, and the slide is like 5 seconds. And it's like, what's your involvement in this or this product? But I think if you just address it up front in a more genuine and transparent way, it's relatively easy to solve for, right? Because everyone, physicians and people on the industry side, they know how all of this works, right? The two parties have to come together. Like, industry is not going to function without collaboration with physicians, you know, and you guys aren't going to get new technology or devices to use without, you know, a group of people, investors, business folks coming together to actually build it, you know? And so the two have to collaborate together, but I think the key is just transparency, right? And being honest about kind of, you know, the particular, you know, company or startup or whatever that you're involved with. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I'm going to go off on a tangent here. You said you, as always, you said you just went through a round of financing and a lot of them were physicians. Where do physicians that don't know you or don't know about your company, like, go to find information about these opportunities? So you have your IVL, super hot topic, you know, competitor to Shockwave. That's kind of a no-brainer if you have the data to go into. Where do I find out about that? And because I feel like I missed that.
Yeah. I wish there was almost like an angel list, right? Or something like that for crowdfunding. These deals. I think
there should be a thing called MD crowdfunding.
Yeah.
Like just MD. Think about an open platform. How needed is it that there could be an MD crowdfunding platform where new devices get put out there? And as a physician, you get to analyze it. And you're the only thing is obviously you're going to play with less. But I'm sorry to interrupt. So it's like, okay, brilliant idea. Let's build this other company for MD crowdfunding.
Yeah. Well, it's never been easier actually to actually execute against that idea because of the new regulations in investing in startups. You know, WeFunder is a good platform as an example. And they've got some device and life science companies on that platform. But this idea of raising money from a community, it's really, really kind of picking up steam. You know, one of the companies that I saw do it really well was in the life sciences space was a company called Levels Health. And they were the first company to take a CGM and basically put an app, a wrapper around that to make it very easy for a consumer that doesn't have diabetes, but just wants to kind of measure their, you know, how they respond, what their insulin response is to certain food. They were kind of the first ones to do that, had a huge waiting list, and ended up raising money from I think $5 million, I believe specifically around that number from their community. So I think this idea of having, you know, a Kickstarter-ish type of platform, a WeFunder type of platform specific for devices, I think could make a lot of sense. But, you know, Lucas, you raise a good point. I think there isn't like a one-stop shop to kind of go find, you know, new or interesting deals to potentially invest in. Usually it's just word of mouth, right? You know, knowing that, oh, so-and-so does a lot of, you know, med tech investing, or this person in industry, you know, I'll give a shout out to a guy like Gary McCord, who is an exceptional business person, but is just, you know, has the Midas touch when it comes to, you know, early stage private companies. And so a lot of people that know Gary know that, hey, if he, you know, if he thinks it's good to kind of invest in, a lot of people just, you know, will trust him because he has such an amazing track record. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of offline kind of word of mouth, right? In terms of trying to find and discover these types of opportunities.
So what's next here for Fastwave? Where are you guys at, and what should we be expecting here in the next few quarters?
Yeah, exciting times for sure. We're just on the precipice of starting clinical work. So really excited about what that looks like. We'll commence on that in early next year, and that will accelerate into pivotal trials as well for regulatory clearance and approval. But we've been public about this. We're working on multiple IVL systems, right? So not just one. And so we're really excited about both. One's probably a little bit more of a next gen type of platform. But super excited about the opportunity there.
Are you looking for peripheral, coronary, or both?
Both.
Okay. So your catheters currently can potentially do both, or are you at the stage where you only have sizes for certain indication?
I guess without being mindful of
what it was. If that's a question that could be spoken, I don't know. Yeah. Maybe I'm overstepping.
We're working on balloon catheters for both. Both applications, right? So, sizes and lengths for peripheral and coronary.
What do you think it is? What's the opportunities you see in IVL as compared to, where do you place it? What's it competing against? Is it competing against POBA? Is it competing against atherectomy? And why do you think it has an advantage? Because to be honest, obviously, if there's recalcitrant plaque, IVL is a good choice. But in my mind, say in an SFA, is not my go-to. I might be completely wrong about that. But the paradigm hasn't shifted in my mind where I'm like, okay, IVL is at the forefront of my treatment paradigm. So I know it's extremely safe as far as embolization rates and the such and increasing compliance. But I find the limited length of the catheters a limiting factor with the current catheters that we have. So I think that might be a big hurdle. Where do you see it? Where do you think you have the advantage? And how are you going to convince me to change what I do?
Yeah, it's a really good point. You touched on a number of challenges, right, with the current IVL technology on the market. And this is not to undermine what Shockwave has done. They've done an exceptional job kind of creating, you know, making this technology available. I think it's definitely taken off more so in the coronaries, right? You can see that with their publicly reported revenue. And so in the coronaries, it's I think it's definitely a more it's definitely more of a default part of a, of a of an algorithm in the coronaries for in terms of vessel prep, you know, before a DES is implanted. On the for peripheral applications, there's a lot more constraints though, right? Length of balloon being one of the most significant ones. And I think until that challenge is solved, which I think our next gen system, I think will possibly do that. Until that challenge is solved, it's going to be, you know, quite challenging to use on any sort of consistent basis in the periphery. I think below the knee applications for really complex diffuse disease, I think there's a lot of opportunity there as well. But length of balloon is certainly a major challenge for peripheral applications.
I might be wrong on this, but Shockwave doesn't have a CPT code, right? Yeah. So are you guys, you know, I agree with the below the knee problem. And I think, if you have a 100 millimeter balloon, I think that would be great. But it's a very expensive catheter that doesn't get paid for. So have you guys thought about that? How are you approaching that?
Yeah. You're talking about reimbursement?
Correct.
Yeah. For sure. That's another, obviously, on the business side, that is definitely another major challenge, right? Because if you're operating an OBL, or an ASC, like you can't lose money. I mean, then your business will quickly, there'll be no hope, vascular as an example, right? If you're losing money on every case. So I think that's certainly a major challenge. I don't really have, other than time, right? I think with time, we'll see positive changes on the reimbursement side. We've certainly seen that on the coronaries, right? I think there's a new DRG code for inpatients. That was recently announced. That's a major improvement. I think that was the first new DRG in like close to 20 years, something like that. And so I think I'm hopeful, right? I'll put it that way. I'm hopeful that we'll see the same type of progress for peripheral applications.
It'll be interesting as some other reimbursement pathways and tools are under fire. Mm-hmm. Potentially by the lack of data.
Yeah.
If data does pile up to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there is a place for IVL, I would not be surprised at all is as some codes kind of degrade in the reimbursement that there's a compensation to allowing physicians to treat some of these more complex things. Because there are tools that we use on a daily basis that, again, to the Twitterati out there that hate it, yes, are not based on some huge amount of data. But for those of us that do cases, we know that certain calcium, if you don't use an atherectomy device to try to modulate that plaque, you are going to do nothing. You're going to have an underexpanded stent.
Yeah.
You're going to have severe restenosis. That patient's going to be back. And yes, understood, we need more data, but it's not there. It doesn't mean that the tools should just poof and like get out of our hands as they're starting to get at this point by the endless denials that we're all getting and facing into. But anyway, I
think that's where your advantage comes in, because your safety profile of IVL. If you have the same safety profile of Shockwave, which you should based on the mechanism of action, then you'll have a competitive advantage, because I don't worry when I put a Shockwave down into an SFA that I'm going to trash everything down, unless it's obvious that there's thrombus.
Right.
Well, but if I put some other devices, I'm like, like this.
for our listeners, do not look at the video. Scott, I would advise you, and here's one of the cool things in this show is you get to meet all these people, mm-hmm. but then that network can become a web, right?
Yeah.
I'll give you offline and I'll connect you with Trisha Roy. And this vascular surgeon is in Houston and she's doing some tremendous work. Maybe I mentioned this when we met.
You had her on the show. I think I listened to the podcast. Okay. The imaging. She's doing like a lot of like killer bleeding edge stuff in imaging, right?
Well, here's where I think would be really interesting. And I don't think that this is overly costly, but you can do a lot of validation on different plaque morphology in ex vivo amputated limbs of patients that unfortunately have lost the limb-saving fight. And so in order to convert that into a win for society. These people donate their legs. And then Trish comes and scans him with a 7 Tesla MRI and then runs devices through these arteries and then scans them again so that you can actually see the effect that right now we either make up on angiogram because you can't see it, or we try to sort of squint our eyes and say that on IVUS we see the spicle micro fragments after you run a specific, you know, device. But this is a true opportunity in us, in a company at your stage, to potentially put some meat on the bone and say, hey, here is the true effect. Yeah. Here is why a long tibial, because here's the other thing, is all plaque is different, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes within the same vessel, there's plaque that's completely different, proximally and distally, and some may be soft, and some may be chronic clot, and all these high-level complexities. But the fact of the matter is that if you can prove beyond the reasonable doubt that this particular device modulates calcium in certain areas, and you add that data, and then you come and you find the clinical data, and to your point, and then you add the IDE, and you have this other company that's kind of trailblazed and picked up and some headwinds in reimbursement, I think you have a killer opportunity to add in the areas where this one company, the trailblaze, didn't necessarily add, and how that's going to give you that competitive advantage, which is already there, based on a free market, right? If anybody buys you and you got two cars, you decide which one you like the most. But how cool would it be that you get the chance to maybe add more to the story on the front end that'll deliver a stronger back end?
Yeah, no, I love that. And I'd love an intro to Trisha. I think that'd be phenomenal to kind of work with her in that capacity. And on that note, Miguel, one of the interesting things about electric-based IVL, right, which is shockwave, is because of that energy source, it doesn't allow you to tune the cavitation bubble with a great degree, right? It's almost like you're kind of there's not a lot of precision there. I'll put it that way. But there's a lot of other energy sources, right, that do allow you to modify the acoustic field. And I think that could have a lot of interesting ramifications, right? If you're able to use a 7 Tesla MRI to figure out, okay, what's the best, what is the ideal acoustic field, right, to effectively modify plaque consistently, right, in the majority of use cases across the board.
That's awesome.
That's super interesting.
Well, Scott, look, I told you we'd steal an hour. I think it's been an hour and a few minutes. It's one of the cool things about this. Sometimes you just fly and you realize how long you've been going. There's no true perfect podcast time. It just is what it is.
It is what it is.
But I want to be respectful of your time and your work. Thank you very much for coming, for being here with us. It's been awesome, inspiring in so many ways. And hopefully we can have you later on when you've progressed a little bit more on this awesome project, and you can tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, when you sell and you're like off in the Mediterranean, like with a linen shirt.
He already sold you and made a ton of money. Come on, man. Well, he's already in it. He's on Starlink. He's up in space. Yeah, he's with Elon.
That's right.
We didn't ask him where he was.
Thank you enough, guys, for having me on. We covered a lot though. We talked about Instagram influencers, right? Bright red lights and, you know, how to tune an acoustic window on an IVL device, right? I mean, but no, this has been fun. I love what you guys are. I really, really genuinely love what you guys are doing, for sure. Hope you continue to push out this type of content.
Thanks. You want to plug in your podcast?
Yeah. MedSider. It's MedSider. MedSider.com is the website. You can just do a search on any sort of podcast app and you'll find it there as well. And then Fastwave Medical's fastwavemedical.com, just as it sounds. Those are the two things that I'm mostly working on these days. Fastwave being, you know, being the big one on the plate right now.
All right, Scott. Well, thank you very, very much from us to you. And how we say it back in my country, pura vida. And we'll be in touch.
Gracias.
Bye. Very good.